All right, everybody, so here we freaking are. First session for American Origins. This is material I haven't discussed in about 5 years since I quit doing this sort of thing full time. So we'll see how we go. I've got so much that I want to talk to you guys about this week, it would make you puke. That's actually kind of a paraphrase from Steve Martin's The Jerk. So I'm going to try to keep the housekeeping stuff to an absolute minimum, and just to explain to you how this all works. And then I'm going to dive right into it. And I think the way I did it was that we'll talk about the New England economy a little bit at the beginning of next week's session. But I left it out of these slides because I realized that there's just so much to do. We're not going to get to it. And I'd rather not have to return to the same slides. So let's just forget that for now. The way this works is I talk for a while. Then we break for about 10 minutes. We come back and do questions. Now tonight we have a strict end time. We've got to be out of here by absolute latest 8:45 p.m. because Stefan Kinsella has to come on. Only one person can be on the system at once. I forgot to click record. I forgot to do it. Now we're rolling. Okay. Well, none of that stuff was relevant anyway, so it's okay if it's not in the recording. So I'm going to get the questions by looking at the question submission link that's on the course page. Questions for this for lecture one. That's how I'll go through them, and then at the end, at that point, I'll invite any additional questions submitted through the chat window. Now, I'm not monitoring the chat window while I'm talking because I can do only one thing at once. So if you're screaming at me, if the thing behind me is on fire, the chat window is not the way to reach me. You're gonna have to call me on the phone or something. So don't be offended if I'm not answering you. I can't watch the chat window. But then after the break, I'll be watching it. Anybody who wants to take the course for a grade, the way I'm going to do it is just 4 multiple choice quizzes. That's all, every other week. So we'll do one next week. And the way it'll work is every Tuesday, probably late in the day, you'll get the questions. You'll get the questions without the multiple choice answers given, but you'll know what the questions will be. And that'll help guide your reading. Because as you saw this week, this reading is extremely detailed and involved, and you can't be expected to know everything. So this helps to helps to focus your reading a little bit. And then on the Friday of the week of a quiz, that's when the quiz opens. And you have Friday, Saturday, and then Sunday up to 11:59 p.m. And I don't know how that works for time zones, so just try and do it before Sunday. But well, you basically have those 3 days where the whole quiz will be there with the multiple choice answers, and you go ahead and answer them. And if you don't want to take the quizzes, that's perfectly fine. I'm not going to think any less of you. If you don't do so well on the quizzes, I won't think any less of you. I know we're all extremely busy. I think it's a miracle you guys are here at all. So that's all great. Okay. Let me just ask, is Danny Sanchez here with us? Is he in the room? Let me just find that out. Okay, he is. Okay, so in case anything disastrous occurs. All right, Danny, did I miss any obvious opening thing? Because I'd like to zip right along if I can. I'd like to start right in. Nope? Okay, good. Okay, everybody, here we go. I'm going to tell you from the outset that the reason I'm starting with colonial New England, even though strict chronology would require me to begin with Jamestown, because that settlement is made in 1607, is really that it's not just because I'm from New England, but it's that when you cover colonial New England, it is absolutely unavoidable that you have to talk about religion. And not only do you have to talk about religion, you have to talk about religious differences. You have to talk about Catholicism, Anglicanism, and Puritanism at the very least. And I feel like once that's out of the way, and we've got all these concepts in our minds, then it becomes a lot easier to apply them to all the other colonies. I can just tell you that by and large, the settlers in Jamestown were Anglicans, and everybody knows what that means. We don't have to dwell on that. So I think this is actually the most efficient way to do it, and that's why I'm doing it this way. Now also, I yield to no one in my admiration and love for Murray Rothbard. I think you all know that. I do have some differences of opinion with him on this. I think, I'm not a Puritan myself. I wouldn't want to live in Puritan society. I wouldn't even be allowed to live in Puritan society. And certainly the Puritans are not libertarians. I get that. I understand that. But I think sometimes they deserve slightly better treatment than he gives them, and I think sometimes he really assumes the worst about their intentions and what they did. I just want you to be aware there is another, there are other scholarly traditions in covering the Puritans that are more sympathetic to them without actually saying, I'd love to live in Puritan society and these are the greatest people who ever lived. I think the real history of the Puritans is more nuanced and I think even more interesting, that they, they were certainly fallible, fallen human beings, but they weren't always just monomaniacal villains. And I want to try and give some of the texture of that. But as I say, Rothbard's a great scholar, and he knows an enormous amount about the colonial period. I mean, the secondary literature that he mastered is nothing to shake a stick at. So I don't want to dispute that, but I just think we should admit various interpretive traditions here. All right, off we go. Now we have to begin with some religious background. I'm going to do this as quickly as possible. If this were a Western Civ course, believe me, you would be subjected to lots and lots of this. But unfortunately, I can't do that to you. Here, I just want you to understand a little bit of the way the Puritans think. And we need to understand that in order to understand how their society was organized. So I want to start with a little something about the Protestant Reformation. And you may find it odd that I have Martin Luther here on the screen and not John Calvin. Now, it's true that the Puritans are Calvinists. They're followers of John Calvin. That's where their theology comes from. But the key insight that we need to look at theologically in order to understand the Puritans' organization of their society in colonial New England is predestination. And it's actually not Calvin but Luther who really gets the ball rolling talking about predestination in a Protestant sense. So that's why I want to talk about him, even though the Puritans are much more influenced by Calvin. Okay, so what I want to talk about here is just simply that there was an event in the 16th century called the Protestant Reformation. And I do not want to take for granted that people know about this. I taught college kids for 7 years, and I could probably count on 2 hands how many students coming into that class knew anything about the Protestant Reformation. As far as they know, Christianity is divided up into a whole bunch of denominations, and they don't know how any of them came into being, nor do they care, or what any of them mean, or how they differ from each other. So I'm not taking that for granted. What I'm going to say is that at the time Martin Luther lived, and I had people who thought he was Martin Luther King, by the way, at the time Martin Luther lived, Christianity and Catholicism were synonymous in Western Europe. They were, by and large, one and the same. Luther, of course, comes along and has his famous dissent from Catholicism that then gives rise to a whole religious movement in opposition, a movement that in turn splinters. So it's not simply that either you're a Catholic or you're a follower of Martin Luther. People who split from Catholicism sometimes also split from Luther, much to his chagrin. So I want to look at what was his key issue, what were some of his key areas of disagreement with the Catholic Church. I mean, certainly he's got plenty in common with the Church. I mean, he believes in the divine inspiration of the Bible. He believes that God is a Trinity, that's three persons in one God. Various things of this nature. But he has a great many important disagreements, and we're focusing here on only a couple of them. Now, Luther, it was originally assumed, would go into law. This was a way to make money in his day, and that's what his father wanted him to do. His father was a copper miner. He's born in and around Saxony. And Luther instead winds up entering a monastery. And the story is that around 1505, he was caught in a terrible storm. And it was so terrible, he wasn't sure he would survive it. And so he prayed to St. Anne that he would be delivered safely from the storm, and that if he were delivered safely, he would become a monk. He would devote himself to the service of God. And when he was delivered from the storm, he decided that devoting himself to the service of God was equivalent to entering the monastery, so that his whole life was consecrated to God's service. So that's what he decides to do. So of course we all know that a monk lives a fairly rigorous spiritual regimen. I mean, it's really like it's like military life, except spiritual. It's extremely, there's a fixed order of the day. you know, you rise at a particular time and you have an early morning prayer and then you have breakfast and you're ready for the day and you have studies and everything is spelled out very clearly. And so Luther entered the religious life. Now, he suffers from extreme scrupulosity. He should never have been admitted to the monastery in the first place. And certainly his reasoning, I mean, this storm thing, this is not a reason to enter a monastery, but nevertheless he was in. And when I say extreme scrupulosity, what I mean is he was constantly examining himself for sinful thoughts. And it got to the point where he couldn't bear to look at a crucifix on the wall. Because there's the image of Christ, it was like he was constantly being accused, and he was all too aware of his sinful nature. He began to impose a very, very rigorous regimen of spiritual and physical mortification on himself. That is to say, I mean, physically punishing his flesh as a punishment for his departure from the purity of thought that he was called to as a monk. And as time went on, this was sort of kind of creeping out the other monks, and he was taken aside by his religious superior, Staupitz, who said to him, you can't do this, right? I mean, at some point you just have to come to terms with your problems here. And Luther was just a basket case spiritually. And finally, his religious superior told him to take comfort in reading the Bible and particularly the letters of St. Paul. Luther takes this advice, and in particular, he finds himself struck by, and he was a great scriptural scholar, Luther, so it wasn't like he had never read the scriptures before, but he's particularly struck on this occasion by the verse, the just man lives by faith. And this becomes the basis of his whole sort of spiritual revolution. What is meant by the just man lives by faith is that the justified man lives by faith. And that in turn refers to the religious concept, the Christian concept of justification. And we have to understand this, as you'll see in a few slides from now. Justification is the process by which the soul becomes pleasing to God. Now, in the Catholic view, this is a lifelong struggle to make the soul pleasing to God, because no one's perfect and everybody sins. And when you sin, the soul becomes, you know, soiled in effect. And the sacraments cleanse the soul so that it becomes whiter than snow, as one of the Psalms puts it. But for Luther, he didn't view it this way. He, as we'll see in mature Lutheran theology, the view is not that the soul actually becomes cleansed of sin, but rather that the sin is covered over by the righteousness of Christ, as with a cloak. So this is why Luther says that the justified man is a snow-covered dunghill. So he's a dunghill because that's his sin, but the dunghill is not actually cleansed. The dunghill is merely covered over with the righteousness of Christ so that, you know, God can sort of bear to be in your presence because of that cloak covering over the sins. So this is, in effect, a one-time thing. It's not a lifelong series of spiritual struggles where you sin and fall and receive the sacraments and sin and whatever, and you hope that you're in the state of grace at the moment of your death. Rather, this is a matter of, at a particular moment, coming to understand what it means to believe in Christ, to realize that you are helpless. It is impossible for you as a fallen human being to live according to God's law. You reconcile yourself to this, and in believing, in embracing faith, this in effect covers over your sins and makes you justified. So the just man lives by faith. When Luther translated the Bible, he translated this verse as the just man lives by faith alone. So that is to say, for your soul to become pleasing to God, all that is necessary is faith alone. Not any kind of works, not praying the rosary, not going on pilgrimages, not receiving sacraments, none of these things, not doing good deeds. None of these things build up any sort of heaven credits for you. It is faith alone that achieves your justification. And so when Luther came to this conclusion, he found that an enormous weight had been lifted from his shoulders, that instead of constantly judging himself and reproaching himself for falling so far short of spiritual perfection, now he could say, look, no, the one thing I know about myself is that I have faith. And because of that faith, I am justified. And I don't need to torment myself And finally, I can enjoy the kind of the freedom of the Christian. And so what we see taking shape here is, first of all, the Reformation principle of faith alone, justification by faith alone. And another important principle, interpretive principle, is the Bible alone. The exclusive source of religious knowledge for the Christian is the Bible alone. That is it. The Catholic view had been that there were two sources, the Bible and tradition. Luther rejects this and says the Bible alone is our authoritative source. All right. Now I proceed from that to the concept of predestination. And then, in fact, because this might be, for all I know, totally new to everybody, I will actually pause to make sure people are getting this. Predestination, when we talk about predestination in the Christian sense, in fact, here I've never done this before. I'm going to pose a question to you guys. Why not? Okay, when we say that you are that some aspect of your life is predestined, we don't mean that the occupation you're going to pursue is predestined, or that, you know, every single thing you do is predestined. What precisely is meant? What aspect of your life is predestined according to the doctrine of predestination? All right, let's see what people know this. Do people know this? It's not just the outcome, specifically the outcome of what? Of the afterlife. Good. Okay. So what? Salvation? Okay. Exactly. So whether or not you are heading to heaven or hell, according to predestination, this has been determined before the beginning of time. Whether you, John Smith, or you know, Fred Barnes, I don't know where I got the Weekly Standard columnist from, but whoever, your eternal fate in the afterlife has been determined for you from the beginning. Now, by the way, just so you know, all these slides don't take this long. The later slides are just go by very quickly. These early ones take a longer time. So whether you're going to heaven or hell does not depend on whether you were a good person or not. They would consider it to be, I mean, a Lutheran or really any form of Protestant would, or I suppose not any. There are some free will people. But certainly the early Protestants and some Protestants today would consider it an outrageously heretical statement for you to say that you'll get to heaven because you're a good person. That is outrageous for you to claim that you could earn your way into heaven when, in fact, everybody falls short of the standard that God holds up for us. We are all short of it. And so that's what predestination is arguing. And it really derives from the concept of original sin, that because of the original sin in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, this infects the souls of every person who comes into this world. And it makes it impossible for you, in effect, to do good. I mean, in the Protestant view, or certainly the Lutheran and Calvinist view, original sin is so overwhelming of a force that it makes it impossible for you to do anything that pleases God, even anything that looks, something that looks outwardly good. Well, even then, you know, your motivations, maybe even unbeknownst to you, may be bad. You're doing it out of a desire to draw attention to yourself or whatever. But we are just absolutely perverse. It is a total depravity. It's actually one of the Calvinist planks. People are totally depraved because of original sin. And so as a result of that, you see how this leads to predestination. Because we've got the idea human beings are absolutely rotten. Absolutely rotten. But yet we know that some people are in heaven. But how could they possibly have gotten into heaven if they're absolutely rotten? And the answer is God would have to have just chosen them. They don't deserve heaven. So the only way somebody could get in is if God just chooses to bring them in, not through any merits of their own. Now, Luther taught what we call single predestination. Now, this is a distinction that you would get probably in a graduate course, but I can't help pointing this out. Luther argued that God chooses the people who go to heaven. But the people who go to hell, well, that's their own fault. They send themselves to hell. Calvin thought that was kind of really a cop-out. That no, we have to embrace that God chooses the people who go to heaven, and he chooses the people who go to hell. And it's just entirely through the grace of God that you go to heaven, and it's through God's decision that you go to hell. And you know, who knows on the basis on which he decides this, but decided he does. So this is what the Puritans believe. They believe in predestination. And as we're going to see, that's going to have political consequences. This seemingly abstruse theological doctrine is going to have political consequences. All right, Let me first ask, not whether you, what I just want to know is, does everybody just get the basic points here? Everybody's following this. There's nothing that I skipped, nothing that's unclear. Everybody's with this. Okay, all right, off we go. Finally, we have to say something about, and I'll take questions about any of this later. We have to look at the Church of England. The Church of England occupies a kind of an oddball position in all this. Oh, good. Okay, even the Calvinists accept what I'm saying. That's good. Okay, so the Church of England occupies this sort of oddball position because it doesn't come right out and say it's either Catholic or Protestant as time goes on. Initially, the Church of England really is just the Catholic Church in England. But as many of you know, and this, again, not being a European history course, I'm not going to do much on this, but again, in the question session, you can ask whatever you want. But basically what you have is you have King Henry VIII, and we all know he had the six wives. And in the early 1530s, he's getting kind of a little bit antsy with his wife Catherine of Aragon because he wants a male heir and she's not producing him one, and he believes that it's the wife who, you know, it's just that he's got a bad wife, and that's why he's not having a male heir. Well, turns out that's not his problem. So anyway, he wants to marry Anne Boleyn, who refuses to be his mistress. She wants to be his wife. And so he's got to get rid of Catherine of Aragon. He's got to get an annulment of his marriage. And the Pope sides with Catherine, who protests to him that there are no grounds for annulling that marriage, that he knew full well the nature of marriage. He knew what he was getting himself into. So they were arguing back and forth about the validity of the marriage, and the Pope was having none of it. Well, finally, as time goes on, Henry VIII has now impregnated Anne Boleyn. So it's now quite urgent for him to annul the marriage with Catherine. So what he finally has to do is to break with the Pope entirely, is to argue that from now on, he does this in 1533, 1534, 1535, that from now on there are no more appeals to the religious establishment in Rome to be made from England. They will not be considered valid. They're not allowed to be made. No appeals are to be made. The Archbishop of Canterbury is our highest ordained authority, but the highest religious authority in the country is now King Henry VIII himself. And St. Thomas More and St. John Fisher, I suppose I'm betraying my bias by calling them saints. My apologies, I withdraw that. Thomas More and John Fisher were later executed because they refused to consent to this. Their view was that he had no right to declare himself the head of the church. And, of course, also this is a dangerous mingling of church and state, of these spheres that ought to be separate. So once Henry does this, though, just because he breaks with the Pope over the issue of the annulment of his marriage, and his authorities, Thomas Cranmer, grants him the annulment, says that his marriage to Catherine of Aragon is null and void, and his new marriage to Anne Boleyn is valid. But that doesn't make him a Lutheran. He did not believe in what Luther taught, and the liturgy and the mass and the preaching in England was completely unchanged. The only thing that was changed was that the prayer for the Pope in the mass was removed. But that prayer had always been said silently, so the average parishioner does not even notice any change at all. Whereas in parts of Europe where the Protestant Reformation was in full swing, you noticed a lot of changes. I could list a whole bunch of them, but you don't notice them in England. So when after Henry dies in the late 1540, I think 1547, then he did have the male heir. It's Edward VI. He had Edward VI with Jane Seymour, his third wife. Edward VI is 9 years old. So a regency is set up. The regency is dominated by Protestants. So Protestant teaching begins to seep into England for the next 6 or so years. Then it has to take a few steps back with the accession of Mary in the 1550s. And then finally, with the rest of the century, with Queen Elizabeth, there's a kind of uneasy middle of the road, but Protestantism begins to make inroads into England. You begin to see more and more of the Protestant teachings beginning to worm their way in. But from the Puritan point of view, the Puritans are people who think that the Protestantizing of England is not occurring fast enough, and it's not widespread enough, it's not systematic enough. They think that there are far too many remnants of Catholicism remaining in the Church of England, particularly in the liturgy, that is the formal worship. They say this worship service that we've got is an absolute insult to God. It is full of superstitious ceremony and all kinds of popish accretions, whereas the Puritans want to purify this liturgy to return it to what they consider to be the type of worship you would have had in apostolic times. They assume that in apostolic times you had a very, very simple, bare-bones sort of liturgy. In fact, Calvin himself, for example, believed no musical instruments should be used at all in the church. Nothing that would distract the worshiper from his individual relationship with God. And it should not be the center of the liturgy of the worship should be the preaching. That's where the center should be focused. Not on the Eucharist or anything. It should be focused on the preaching. So they are very much opposed to the pomp and ceremony that they believe is in the worship. They don't like the organizational structure of the English church with all the bishops. They favor a much more decentralized church organization. And they also think that at times the Church of England is unsound or not as sound as it ought to be when it comes to justification by faith alone. So they have a variety of grievances. And in particular, obviously with the passage of time, they're not especially happy that they themselves are periodically persecuted, jailed, their property confiscated, because their own worship, their own churches, are really in defiance of the official religion of the country. I mean, if the king, if the monarch is the head of the church, then, you know, that's the religion you darn well better belong to if you want to stay out of trouble. And so the Puritans are upset about that, too. Okay, that's the background. Here we go. There are two Puritan settlements we're going to focus on primarily tonight. I'll say a little bit more about Connecticut a little bit at the beginning next time. Thomas Hooker and John Davenport starting up the Connecticut and New Haven colonies in the 1630s. We're just going to focus on Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay. The Plymouth colony, these are the people we refer to as pilgrims. This is the first of the permanent Puritan settlements in New England. And they are called pilgrims, but people should also know they're also Puritans. All these people we're talking about tonight are Puritans. It's not like some people are pilgrims and some people are Puritans. They're all Puritans. The pilgrims are just the first of the Puritans. Plymouth, of course, we're talking about Massachusetts. This is where they settle. So these are people who leave England because they believe that the religious situation is hopeless. They're observing the trajectory of history on the European continent, and they're displeased with the fortunes of Protestantism, and they're afraid that this could be a sign that God's wrath is about to be unleashed on the sins of England, and that they want to get out, and they want to go somewhere where they're not going to be harassed. So some of them, initially they're going to go to Holland as a place of refuge, but they find two problems there. Rothbard focuses on the fact that the Dutch are not as observant of Puritan morality as the Puritans themselves are, but it's also that they hadn't realized before just how keen they were on raising their children to be good British gentlemen and ladies, and it's very hard to do that in the atmosphere of Dutch culture. And so ultimately they decide to leave there and make their way to Plymouth, which they do in 1620. They establish, they're supposed to settle someplace a little bit to the south of where they do settle. And when they do, in fact, finally settle at Plymouth, while they're still on board the Mayflower, they draw up something called the Mayflower Compact, which is a statement that, in effect, commits them all to obey this new government that they're going to establish. These Puritans who settle in Plymouth we call separatists or separating Puritans. And here I think there's maybe just a slight correction to the Rothbard text, because he uses separatist and non-separatist a lot. But I want to explain what those terms mean is simply this. Everybody, all Puritans believe that the Church of England is a rotten mess. The difference is that a separatist Puritan believes that it is such a rotten mess that we have to expressly repudiate it and turn our backs on it forever. Now that's different from what we'll see in just a minute A non-separatist Puritan would say, I agree with you, the Church of England is rotten and terrible, we all need to get away from it, but we can't just turn our backs on it forever. The point of our settlement has to be to create a kind of a beacon to the world. We have to be an example to show how wonderful society can be. We can transform society through the strength of Puritanism. We have to be the beacon that leads to the reform of the Church of England, that somehow by observing our great example and in effect how generous we are with each other and how peaceful and prosperous our society is, this will, in some way that we can't even articulate, this will lead to the Reformation, the full Reformation of the Church of England. So in other words, it's kind of a rhetorical thing. It's a matter of their posture toward the rest of the world. We could think of the separatist Puritans as being genuinely isolationist in the genuine sense of that term. We don't, you know, give, you know, people in England can take care of themselves. Forget about them. The non-separating Puritans are the ones who felt that, no, part of our mission to the new world is to serve as an example that can itself lead to the regeneration of the Church of England. And the non-separating Puritans, the people who settle in Massachusetts Bay, starting in 1630, that we'll look at in a minute, those people think that it's absolutely wrong to just turn their backs on the Church of England. That is uncharitable. That does not show adequate Christian charity. Okay, we're not going to spend that much time on Plymouth, though, because if you wonder over the course of the 8 weeks, you know, whatever happened to Plymouth, we don't really talk about it anymore. By the 1640s, Plymouth is practically a ghost town. It always had very, very few settlers to start with, had a very rough winter the first year they were there. It has become really an economic backwater of Massachusetts Bay by that time. And within several decades, it in fact is absorbed by the Crown into the Massachusetts Bay settlement. Okay, Massachusetts Bay, this is the primary area of Puritan settlement. And so as you can see on the screen, we've got some 21,000 people emigrating to Massachusetts Bay during that decade. This is a family-oriented migration, unlike, as we'll see next week, colonial Virginia, which was dominated by young bachelors. So you can imagine, take a wild guess how that turned out. These are, as I say, the non-separating Puritans, and that aspect of their thinking is symbolized in the City Upon a Hill excerpt that I gave you from John Winthrop's sermon, A Model of Christian Charity. And there, now again, I'm not a Puritan, I'm not sympathetic to them really in any way, but I find it hard not to be attracted at least to the beauty of the language in Winthrop's City Upon a Hill when he speaks about his ambitions for the Puritan colony and that we have to deal justly with each other and show kindnesses to each other because the whole world is watching us. Now, I think he was flattering himself when he said that, but we shall be as a city upon a hill. This is a biblical image. And I always find it funny when people say, as Ronald Reagan said, we are a city upon a hill. Okay, well, John Winthrop said it before him, and it's in the Bible before that. But the idea of the city upon a hill is that we are, in effect, on a world stage. Everybody's observing us. And if we shall do a bad job here, and if we shall commit sin and frankly, fail to punish sin and fail to bring about a just society, then God will depart from us, and we shall fail, and we shall be the laughingstock of the world. And this will bring shame upon everything we believe in. But on the other hand, if we are committed to this and we work together as one person with one heart, keeping the bond of peace and the unity of faith and so on and on, then, well, you know, the fruits will be worldwide, in effect. So that's what the city upon a hill imagery is referring to. It's a reflection of their non-separating philosophy. Okay, so now they get to Massachusetts Bay, and now, okay, the whole point of going, or good large point of going, was partly for religious reasons to avoid persecution, partly for economic reasons because the economy in Britain was not particularly good at that time. But so a key thing is now we've got to set up our churches. Oh, wait, did the video stop? Okay, no, video's still good here. Okay. All right, so now they're going to set up their churches. Now, this historians are at a bit of a loss about this, about what they try to do here. Because it's not clear why they thought of this or where this came from, because this wasn't the way they were setting up their churches back home. What they're trying to do in the churches they establish is to, well, let me explain this phrase that's on the screen here, the elect. The term the elect refers to the people God has chosen for eternal salvation. the people God has chosen for heaven. Those are referred to as God's elect. We don't know who those people are because they don't have the word heaven is not tattooed on their foreheads. We don't know who they are. So they are the invisible saints. They are God's elect, but we mortals can't know for sure who they are. But the Puritans are going to try their best. They're going to try to establish their churches such that the only people who are admitted to church membership are people they can be reliably certain are in fact among God's elect. Now, that is an absolutely breathtaking claim that they can try to determine which people among them are going to heaven. And those people alone will be allowed to be members of the church. Now, if you're not a member of the church, by the way, you still have to go to church, because their view is this may be just the thing for somebody like you. And they may change their minds and later on decide to admit you after all. But that's how they're going to decide. That's how they're going to arrange the churches. So how do they do this? How can they figure this out? They can't go by, okay, this seems like a good guy. Because remember, being a good guy does not get you into heaven. So how do they do it? Well, first they begin the process by each church that's established will begin with a self-identified group of seven people called the pillars of the church. And they identify each other basically on the grounds that, well, you know, we're sort of upstanding people. We all know each other. And we all can testify that we've each had an inner conversion experience. That's what the Puritans are going to insist on. Tell us about the moment in which the Holy Spirit moved you and your faith became not just something you read about in a book, but it just became your whole being. Like, we want to know and we want to hear you describe for us that intimate religious experience you had, and then we'll see if we find it persuasive. And they were also of the opinion that although being a good person doesn't earn you heaven, nevertheless, they thought that good works you might carry out were a sign that you were of the elect, that God, in effect, sanctifies you, that God, in effect, he works these good works in you, and that reflects the fact that you are among the elect. It doesn't entitle you to be among the elect. Your being among the elect comes first, and the good works come later. So that good works combined with somebody's own personal testimony could give, they felt, at least a reasonable assurance, the greatest assurance we could expect in this world, that the person was among the elect. Now, they knew they would make mistakes. They would accidentally admit someone who didn't belong as a church member, and they would fail to admit other people who did. But again, they're fallible human beings, and they're doing their best. So everybody is interviewed by the pillars of the church, and they're asked these various questions, and then membership proceeds from that point on. Now, we've already said what the qualifications are. You have to, in effect, be subjected to these sorts of this sort of questioning and demonstrate these things to them to their satisfaction. But what do you get being a church member? I mean, everybody has to go to church, so what do you get? Two basic things that are essential for us to understand. One is religious, one is political. The religious thing is that you can receive the Lord's Supper, which is, of course, at least occasionally part of the Puritan worship. But secondly, you can vote in the colony. You can vote for governor, for example. You can vote for delegates to the general court. So now you see why, building all this up, where it all leads. This is why predestination is relevant to U.S. history. Predestination means some people are among God's elect. Well, in this colony, they're going to try to figure out who God's elect are. Okay, now, just one small thing. Strictly speaking, Massachusetts Bay, if you want to be technical about it, is not a theocracy. It's not a theocracy because ministers are actually forbidden to hold political office, and that is the technical definition of a theocracy. But in more looser terminology, we could perhaps use that term. Okay, let's move on here. Okay, now let's say a little something. We said a little something about religious life. What about political life? Okay, well, King Charles I likely did not realize that when the Puritans did make this move in 1629 to 30 to Massachusetts Bay, the area around Boston, he did not realize that this was a bunch of dissenters who were establishing themselves in the new world. He very likely assumed that this was another profit-making enterprise because it was a bunch of investors and they expect to make a profit from it, and this is fine with him. But the key thing is that when the king grants a charter to the joint stock company that gives rise to the colony, that charter fails to point out where does the stockholders' meeting take place and where do the elections take place. So the colonists, in effect, exploited this omission to say, okay, well, all the meetings are going to take place over here in Boston. And so this meant that this colony now is going to be governed, in effect, with much less oversight from England than anyone back home expected. They're going to get away with murder over here. They're going to get away with basically being able to run this Puritan colony without a king breathing down their throats, because their charter never said anything about this. And so they're going to have their own elections and run their own things from here. Later on in the century, as we'll see later when we do the lecture on a tour of the colonies, we're going to see that the king later revokes this charter. Says, wait, one minute. What have we been letting you people get away with? And then he's going to demand that Anglicans have political rights in colonial Massachusetts and so on. But that's not till later. We're looking at at 1630 right now. So the colonial government consists of an elected governor, a governor's council appointed by the governor, and a general court that has both judicial and legislative powers sort of combined in one, and that's composed of two delegates elected from each town. The laws in colonial Massachusetts, of course, proscribe, and of course, proscribe means forbid, not prescribe, which calls for something, various behaviors that are at odds with biblical injunctions. So you've got for example, adultery would be criminalized. You've got to attend church regularly. There are various punishments meted out to you if you don't, and so on. But it's interesting to note that John Winthrop, who was the highly respected figure who was periodically governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Winthrop's view was that the colony should have as few written laws as possible. And the reason was that he wanted to be able to govern the colony according to the principles in the Bible, and he wanted a lot of leeway to be able to apply those in particular cases. And he thought that a whole bunch of written laws would tie his hands and his fellow lawmakers' hands and judges' hands unduly. So instead, he wants a broad latitude to be able to make decisions. And it's interesting that ultimately the Puritan the people actually voted him out of office over this issue and established the Massachusetts Body of Liberties in 1641, which contains over 100 provisions, many of which lay out exactly what their rights are. And then, as if to make clear there were no hard feelings, they voted him back into office shortly after that. But they did not agree with his view that the government should just have this very broad latitude to govern in accordance with the Bible. They would rather know exactly what they were getting themselves into and what was forbidden and what not, and what were the penalties and what were their rights, and so on and so forth. And some of these things that you find in the Massachusetts Body of Liberties are quite familiar to us, about jury trials and not being taxed without your consent. And I pointed out in my Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, there's a provision in there that forbids beating your wife except if she started it, in which case you can retaliate, apparently. I cannot imagine that was such a big issue that they felt that they had to point out that if your wife beats you up, you can go after her, but who knows what was going on there. Sorry that this quotation came out so badly. It didn't on my screen. Now, how do they deal with dissent? Well, in the covenant of the town of Dedham, Massachusetts, we see a very typical statement that indicates their view. We shall by all means labor to keep off from us all such as are contrary-minded, and receive only such unto us as may be probably one heart with us. All right, well, you know, look, at least they're up front, right? Okay, I want to look at two people who were expelled from the Massachusetts Bay Colony, because that is, I think, an indication of something of the tone of political life. And the first one is Roger Williams. Now, Williams had been living in Salem, Massachusetts, and he was a separating Puritan. But he was even more separatist than the separatists in Plymouth. In fact, he got to a point in his life that he felt that the only person he could pray with was his own wife. So he was taking the view that magistrates could not even administer oaths to people who were unregenerate. He was of the belief, he was, again, an extreme separatist. We've got to absolutely repudiate the Church of England. And he had other statements to this effect, and continuing to promote them. And now Rothbard zeroes in on something, and I want to clarify something. It's true that Roger Williams also argued that the mere patent grant from the king did not entitle the Puritans to just take the Puritans' land. To take the Indians' land. And a lot, or at least some historians, portrayed this as the key issue. That this, we had to go after Roger Williams because he's calling the whole legitimacy of the colony into question, because he's arguing that only voluntary cession from the Indians, sale of the land or grant of the land from the Indians, gives you legitimate grounds for occupying that land. And what I want to explain here, and for example, Alden Vaughan, who's my favorite historian of the Puritans and the Indians, Vaughan, makes this quite clear, that in fact, the debate between Williams and John Winthrop and the others over this issue was actually at a very abstract level. Because in practice, the Puritans of New England did not rely on the fact that the king gave us this land so we could just take it. They didn't. They actually acquired all the land through legitimate purchase, as I'll mention in a minute. So this was not practically speaking, the debate between Williams and Massachusetts had any significance at all. He at no time accused Massachusetts of having defrauded or robbed the Indians, because he knew they hadn't. He was simply arguing that theoretically, just going around and claiming the king's grant as your justification would not have justified what New England did. Now, Winthrop thought it would have justified them, but the point is they didn't actually acquire the land in that way, in practice. So as I said, they're really arguing abstractions here. So that was not the key thing. The key thing was his separatism and his extreme rhetoric toward England that they wanted no truck with. So ultimately he was banished to England. But John Winthrop felt like, well, I wouldn't want my worst enemy to be banished to England. I mean, that's how bad he thought things were in England religiously. The England of Bishop William Laud, who's imposing all this crazy quasi-Catholic stuff on the country, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. So Winthrop tips him off, alerts him that he's about to be nabbed, and so Williams is able to escape to Providence, Rhode Island, which is indeed the Providence of today, that he basically establishes, and that becomes a haven of religious freedom. The second dissenter I want to talk about for a minute is Anne Hutchinson. And the key thing I want to talk about here is her teaching that sanctification does not equal justification. And that sounds very technical, like a very technical, nitpicky, theological point, but actually it's an essential point, because of the two of them, it's Anne Hutchinson who's actually hitting at the heart of the settlement. Now, why is that? Well, let's define these terms. Justification, again, is the process by which the soul becomes pleasing to God. So the just man is the man who has a soul that is pleasing to God. That's what's meant by just in the theological sense. Sanctification is the process by which someone's behavior, in effect, becomes good. That his outward someone is sanctified when his behavior matches his religious belief. So she's arguing that merely because someone happens to be an upstanding citizen, that is no indication that he has a soul that's pleasing to God. That's no indication that he belongs to the elect. Now you see how she's hitting at the heart of the colony. The colony is organized. The whole of voting is organized on the principle that we can ascertain on the basis of basically people's behavior and their testimonies about themselves. We can basically say, yeah, Joe Blow seems to be probably part of the elect because his outward behavior seems to reflect this. She's saying you can't tell anything from somebody's outward behavior. She's in effect saying Hitler, for all we know, could be the highest of the angels and Mother Teresa could be the lowest of the devils. We cannot know this. So that does get to the heart of the matter. And then when she was called to account for this, to explain herself, and they asked her, where are you getting these crazy ideas? She in effect said that she was getting them from direct inspiration from God himself. And now some of you may think, oh, the Puritans must have been very impressed by this. No, the Puritans basically had the same view of that most of us would, which is that, this woman is obviously a little bit touched in the head. The idea that somebody's going to go around contradicting the establishment of the colonies and say that she has a direct channel to God so she can bypass all authorities. Well, now that was a bit too much for them, and she was banished as well, and she found her way to Providence as well. Now, for much of the rest of the session, and I'm going to go a little bit over our initial time because I had to start with the 4 to 5 minutes of introductory material. And just this first time through, I have a lot to discuss, and next week will be a little bit less. It'll all work out in the come out in the wash. I want to talk about Puritan-Indian relations. And here, I cannot emphasize enough how great this book is. This is New England Frontier by Alden Vaughn. And the subtitle is Puritans and Indians, 1620 to 1675. I mentioned this book in my Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, and the only thing I reproach myself for was not emphasizing adequately what a great book it is. The scholarship in here is astonishing, and it reads if not quite like a novel. It's extremely interesting. You will not be bored reading this book. And Vaughn takes and by the way, if you do get the third edition so that you can read the introduction to the second and third editions, which are great because that brings the story up to date with recent scholarship. And what you find is that people who are generalists, who don't specialize in Puritan Indian behavior, but people who write the textbooks, have gotten harsher and harsher and harsher in their treatment of the Puritans, whereas the specialists have gotten more and more and more sympathetic as they've examined things more closely. Now, again, I have no dog in this hunt here. I mean, if the Puritans turn out to be rotten genocidal maniacs, that's fine with me. I couldn't care less. But I read Alden Vaughn. I was assigned that in college, and I also read the other side. I read The Invasion of America by Francis Jennings, and I thought Vaughn had much the better of the argument. So let's dive into this though. There's a great epidemic in 1616 to 1617. That devastated New England Indian populations. They had been at about 25,000 before then, and were down to about 15,000 to 18,000 in all of New England by the time Plymouth was settled. So you got a very, very low population density, about 0.22 per square mile. The Indians of New England all belonged to the family of tribes called the Algonquins. Oh, now you see I'm wearing jeans. I'm sorry, I hate jeans. But here I am. I'm a hypocrite. They're not fun. And by the way, the Algonquins, they could more or less understand each other, even though they were all different tribes under this general umbrella. They could understand each other very, very on a very basic level. But the differences in sort of language, like dialects, you might say, were very, very great. But they all belong to the same rough family. They were not nomadic. They were basically settled. They did move, so this confused the Puritans at first, but they were only moving because the seasons demanded it. You know, in winter, we've got to go here to get our food, and during this time of year, we're going to go here to plant, and so on and so forth. The Puritans' testimony about the Indians is not altogether favorable, but it's not pure denunciation either. The negative testimony was they're lazy drunkards. Now, certainly the Indian women were not lazy. They worked a backbreaking schedule. And the men, well, certainly during a hunting season and when there was some emergency, they would work very, very hard. The alcoholism thing is a little harder to answer because even Indian sources said this. They had no equivalent of really strong drink. And so the Puritans actually tried to keep alcohol away from them. And this actually seems Yeah, again, no, they're not libertarians, but this seems like they were thinking, well, these people have never encountered this before, and this is not helping them, and we want to try and keep it away from them. They didn't always have a lot of success. But they testify that the Indians were especially hospitable and friendly to them. They were willing to help many cases where Englishmen were in need. They lived at a subsistence level, and materially they were, in effect, and I'm not saying this to be disparaging, but just as a historical description, they were really living, in effect, in the Stone Age, materially. Okay, so I already talked about keeping alcohol out of the hands of the natives. I also want to keep weapons. That was the one advantage that the Puritans had. They didn't know the environment nearly as well, but they had weapons that absolutely overawed the Indian populations. And this is the proper context for understanding the incident that you read about in your reading involving Thomas Morton and Marymount, which is the settlement that so irritated the Puritans in Plymouth. Now, the usual portrayal, and this is sort of Rothbard's portrayal, is that Marymount was this place of revelry and moral laxity, and the Puritans hate these things, so naturally they have to go exterminate everybody. I don't think that's really fair. If that had been, if it had simply been, you know, that they were wearing blue jeans and they had free speech, you know, I don't think the Plymouth had enough things to keep them busy, and this was not anything that's not part of their jurisdiction, they would very likely have been left in peace. Their main complaint was that he was arming the Indians. And, you know, they had lived there for 8 years, and so far the Pilgrims had very, very cordial relations with the Indians. It's not a problem, but there's no guarantee of this, and there could be people they've never met before. And, you know, they're in a completely new environment, so this is their view, that they don't want some guy who is, in fact, violating the king's law on this, arming the Indians. So that was their objection. You know, maybe they shouldn't have had that objection, but that was the objection. And so, interestingly, and I think this helps to prove the point, it wasn't actually Plymouth itself that led the charge, that, you know, that took the initiative against Thomas Morton and Marymount. They were a big settlement, relatively secure. It was the outlying settlements around Plymouth that were more vulnerable. They were the ones that really wanted to go after Thomas Morton, so that stands to reason. And they made two appeals to him to listen and abide by the king's injunctions on this, and he ignored that. Okay, let's carry on. Now, again, I almost feel like you're not going to believe me when I say things like this, that the Puritans made effort to prevent their people from mistreating the Indians. This sounds like a whitewash. Like, I can't possibly be telling the truth. But, again, I urge you to read Alton Bond's book. And just, I don't want you to just buy into what you think you know, because that's what you've been taught your whole life. We don't do this in any other aspect of our lives. We don't believe what the U.S. government says about anything. So we should be skeptics. And, for example, Thomas Morton returns to New England in 1629, fires a charge of hail shot at Indians when they would not give him a canoe. And then he goes ahead and takes the canoe anyway. Meanwhile, he injures somebody. He burns some people's garments. So Massachusetts orders him to make satisfaction to the Indians. They sent him off as a prisoner and burned his house to the ground. In fact, I forgot about this. I want to share with you the exact statement from the general court. It's quite something. And I just hang on. It's totally worth doing, because this is quite. In fact, maybe I'll do this after the break. I'll share this with you, because it is really, really worth reading what they had to say to Thomas Morton. Yeah, I'll have to get it after. Let me write myself a note, because I love this statement that he has wronged the Indians, and so it is only fair that we should smack him down. There are numerous other such cases of people coming to Puritan courts, and the Puritan courts ruling against them and making ordering that reparation be made to the Indians when they've been wronged, and I can cite some of those. There's a terrible epidemic in 1633-34 when even some Indians abandoned their fellows, but the colonists basically acquitted themselves very well. They cared for the sick, they tended to the dead, they even took orphans into their homes. When it comes to Indian land, this is an area where I will admit no dissent whatsoever, because here the scholarship is just overwhelming. That the common view, regardless of what may have happened at other times, in other situations, in other parts of this country or other countries, the Puritans did not defraud the Indians of the land. People, I think, believe this because they think, okay, the Indians start off with all the land, and now they have none, so therefore it must have been taken from them. or they must have been defrauded of it, or they must have been handed some worthless trinkets, or they didn't understand the nature of the transaction, or whatever. And this also follows from the argument that there were a lot of Indians to start with, which, as we've seen, there really weren't in New England, right? 15,000 to 18,000 is very, very few. And then, you know, by the 18th century, there are very few, so they must have all been slaughtered. And the Puritans must have had this religious conviction that they're there to slaughter the heathen. And I know people grow up believing this, and exactly the opposite is true. They genuinely, believe it or not, they genuinely wanted to convert the Indians. And I know that's very politically incorrect, but they believed that was their obligation. These people, they did not believe that the Indians belonged to another race. They were not racists toward the Indians. They believed the Indians were whites like them. Roger Williams believed that, John Winthrop, they all believed this. The Indians were whites, and they needed to convert them. They did not want to exterminate them. They believed that they may be one of the lost tribes of Israel, since their obligation to convert them. What basically did the Indians in was, well, war, but that only led to about 15% of them perishing, but also just general migration. And disease, which kept waves of disease kept decimating them. And in fact, the more the Puritans tried to help them, the worse it got. The disease hit Indians the more they interacted peacefully with the Puritans. The Indians who went to Harvard were decimated. The Indians who sat in European schools that were established to educate them were decimated. So it's not like they were trying to do this to them, but it indeed happened. So the Indians were actually quite eager to sell to the Puritans. They've got 0.22 population density. They had more land than they conceivably know what to do with. I'm going to go till 10 after the hour, and then we'll take our break. Whereas to the contrary, they've got this very technologically sophisticated civilization that's coming to them. Who is to stand in judgment of them when they decided that, you know, it would be a lot more helpful to have an iron plow or to have a metal knife or a hoe or any of these other things than it would be to have 5 billion acres of land I'll never use? That was their view. I would much rather take part in the fruits of this highly advanced civilization. Okay, well, you know, who are we to judge that? That was their judgment. And that's why it was the Indians themselves that typically took the initiative. The Indians themselves said, look, hey, look, here, you want to trade? We've got all this land. So it is not the case. Anthropologists have not found one group of New England Indians who held all the land in common or didn't understand what property and land meant. After any initial confusion was squared away, all these deeds were actually extremely detailed. There was very little room for misunderstanding. And in fact, later on, when Indian claimants would go to Puritan courts, more often than not, the Puritan courts sided with them and said, okay, your land was unjustly taken from you. You had only temporarily abandoned it or something. So that actually, the Puritans actually have an excellent record when it comes to this. And that's true of Massachusetts, it's true of the Connecticut settlements, and it's true of Providence, Rhode Island. Now in terms of, I thought I put a space between the second and third things there. In terms of missionary activity, just very quickly, Reverend John Eliot was known as the Apostle to the Indians, and in 1647 he conceived of the project of translating the entire Old and New Testaments into Algonquin. Now, it seems, and again, this is very politically incorrect, how dare they impose their religion on other people? They were imposing it primarily not through coercion, but through persuasion, if that matters. I realize this is very touchy stuff. But the point is, if all they want to do was oppress and kill the Indians, well, there are a lot easier ways than translating the entire Bible into Algonquin. Because consider, Algonquin did not have a written language. So Eliot first has to invent a written language for them, and then translate the entire Bible into that written language. Would you like to try that? I mean, it's just an impossibility. And yet he sets himself to that task. It's an astonishing thing. And people initially didn't believe it could be done. He first started writing a catechism that would help to get the Indians to be able to work with the written language. And that catechism led a guy named Thomas Stanton in Connecticut, another Puritan, you don't even know this guy's name, to the conclusion that, look, the Indians are never going to understand this written language. So I'm going to just try and do my that John Eliot has fashioned for them. They're never going to understand his catechism that he's written for them. I'm going to do my best to come up with my own catechism for the Indians. And so the only reason I'm pointing out Thomas Stanton is, here's one line from the Thomas Stanton catechism that's going to be such an improvement over John Eliot. Here's what Thomas Stanton expected the Indians to be reading. He's trying to explain why there's only one God. Here's what he says. Because singular things of the same kind, when they are multiplied, are differenced among themselves by their singular properties, but there cannot be found another God differenced from this by any such like properties. Oh. So anyway, John Eliot really is the master of this, and by the early 1660s, he had translated the entire Bible into Algonquin. We have the case of the praying towns, of which 14 were established, whereby Indian converts would live apart from the whites, and they could, by and large, govern themselves with some general oversight, but by and large govern themselves away from Indian influences, but away from European influences as well. And finally, Harvard College, which was established in 1636, its 1650 charter makes clear that it is to be for the education of the Indians and the whites, or pardon me, and the Europeans, right, because they are whites. The Indians and the Europeans together. They are supposed to be educated both in this institution, and it was supposed to be the Oxford of the Indians and the Cambridge of the English settlers. That was the ambition for it, anyway. Now, finally, a little bit about the Pequot War. Just briefly on the origins of the Pequot War. First of all, who are the Pequots? So the Pequots had come from the area around the Hudson and made their way into Connecticut and had done so in fairly obnoxious, violent ways, such that practically all the other Indian tribes considered them to be invaders. And in fact, any of the military conflicts, which were quite rare between the Puritans and the Indians, we can't classify them as the Puritans against the Indians, because there were always Indian tribes siding with the Puritans, who took the European side of things. And the Indians did not view themselves as being a single race. They just didn't. They didn't think that way. That's a construction that later historians try to put on this. That is not how they thought of it. So the Pequots, by and large, had left the Europeans alone. But then, in spring of 1634, Captains John Stone and Walter Norton and their seven-man crew were slaughtered. But the exact circumstances are unclear. Now, this John Stone, history does not speak well of this guy. And everybody he met, every authority figure, every community that he visited while on his ship, he was from Virginia, and he would take his ship up the coast to Boston. They all thought very badly of him, so he's apparently a scoundrel of some sort. And at the time he was killed, he was investigating whether the Connecticut Valley area might be a good trading spot. Well, why was he killed? Well, the English at first were under the impression, I'm sorry, I need five more minutes, were under the impression that he'd been killed in his sleep, treacherously. But then the Pequots made overtures to the Puritans to give their side of the story. The reason they made these overtures, by the way, was that at this time, the Pequots were at war with the Dutch and with the Narragansett tribe of Indians. And now the English want to come avenge the death of Captain John Stone. Well, that's, frankly, one enemy too many. So the Puritans make overtures, and they explain, look, this Stone had actually seized and bound two of our braves when they boarded to try to trade with him. And the Puritans concluded that because of the earnestness with which the Pequots told this story, they were inclined to accept that version. So the Puritans are inclined to accept the Pequots' version of events, and a treaty was drawn up between them. And the treaty established various things, that we will establish trading relations between our peoples. We do want two of the assassins, though, because, I mean, after all, you can't justify killing all these people. So we do want two of the assassins turned over to us to be subjected to our system of justice. And we would like the Pequots to stop resisting the migration of Puritans into the Connecticut Valley area. Like, they don't have a monopoly on that. A lot of Puritans were trying to buy land from willing sellers. The Puritans were invited into the Connecticut Valley region by non-Pequot Indians who wanted some kind of buffer against the Pequots. And so part of the treaty was, you have to allow us to do that voluntarily. Well, the Pequots were not holding up their end of the treaty. They did not turn over the assassins of Stone and his crew. And the Puritans are beginning to grow restless. But the key factor here, even beyond this, was near Block Island, a trader named John Oldham was found dead on his ship. And this looks like the work either of the Pequots or of a tribe affiliated with them. And at this point, ultimately, finally the Puritans decide, oh, well, we've got to go after them. So Captain John Endicott and 90 volunteers head to Block Island to take revenge. It's fairly lightly protected, so there are relatively few casualties, but they take this opportunity to engage in vicious reprisals against the Pequots. Wigwams burned, cornfields burned, canoes wrecked and destroyed, and then they proceed to Pequot Harbor and launch 2 days' worth of destruction, again, destroying homes and just everything they can find, and killing. It's horrific. Endicott then returns to Boston with his men, and the Pequots, it's the people who actually bear the brunt of this, are the Puritans living in Connecticut who now bear the brunt of the reprisals from the Pequots. And as time goes on, these reprisals, ultimately about 30 Puritans are killed, including women and children. And then word reaches the colonists back in Boston that the Pequots are trying to arrange for an alliance with the Narragansetts, and these would be two very powerful tribes allied against them, and the colonists decided this is just getting too hot. And so, in fact, interestingly enough, can you believe they have the gall to appeal to Roger Williams, the guy they banished? Roger Williams had an excellent relationship with the Narragansetts, and they appeal to him, please, please, please try to head off this purported alliance. And Williams is successful. And he, in fact, brings about an alliance of the Narragansetts with the Puritans. But the key precipitating factor that ultimately leads to the war is the harshness of that expedition by John Endicott. And in fact, the Plymouth settlement condemned that expedition by Endicott. The Connecticut settlements condemned it. So the Puritans themselves were by no means of one mind on the justice of the Endicott expedition. The Pequots had not, in fact, launched any violent attacks other than perhaps the Stone case, but even that may have been in self-defense, until the harshness of that Endicott expedition. The main battle in the Pequot War is the Battle of Mystic Fort. And here, well, to make a long story short, the Puritans wound up setting most of this area on fire. And as people were desperately, you either died because you were burned to death, or as people were desperately trying to flee the flames, the Puritans formed a kind of a circle around the fort, and as people were fleeing, they were mowing them down. It's a horrendous, horrendous ordeal. We don't know the exact number of deaths, but it's somewhere between 400 and 700. The Puritan victory is decisive. They then track down some of the people fleeing, and ultimately it is a dramatic change in the balance of power between the Europeans and the Indians, because now it's clear who has the upper hand. The Pequots are not completely exterminated, however. I mean, I do want to at least make this point clear. There is technically no Pequot tribe after this, but that doesn't mean every single one of them was tracked down and killed. It was that they were not allowed to continue living as the Pequot tribe. The survivors were absorbed into other tribes, which, you know, again, may be a harsh thing, but it's still not exactly the same thing as murdering every single one of them. Finally, let me just leave you with this before we end with our break. And again, these won't go on this long each time, but just with New England, I just had a lot I wanted to say. I want to read this to you. This is from Alden Vaughan's book. And this is Vaughan talking about the Puritans' legal system. And he's trying to make the case that when the Puritans dealt with the Indians, they did the best they could in being impartial. And by 17th century standards, when you're dealing with two radically different peoples, they were tremendously successful. And let me just read this to you, and then we'll break. He says, the most remarkable evidence of Puritan impartiality. And by the way, certainly there's no defense of the Pequot War is a horrific atrocity, and I'm not disputing that. But I just found this a quite interesting episode. The most remarkable evidence of Puritan impartiality is to be found in an episode connected with the Pequot War. The massacre of 9 settlers, including women and children, at Wethersfield, Connecticut in 1637 had been the final atrocity before the River Colony's declaration of war, the River Colonies, another word for Connecticut. It later became known that the local Wangook tribe, led by Chief Seguin, had invited the Pequots to make the raid and had thereby actively conspired against the English. Seguin and his tribe were guilty not only of abetting the enemy at the cost of many English lives, but they had violated their covenant with the Wethersfield settlers in doing so. It would not have been surprising had Seguin and the Wangooks felt the full force of Puritan revenge when the truth became known. The logic of the situation would seem to demand that the Wangooks share the fate of the Pequots. Had the Wethersfield settlers been free to act as they saw fit, Seguin and his followers would probably have suffered for their perfidy. But revenge could not be taken without the approval of the General Court of Connecticut. And when the issue was brought before it in the spring of 1638, the Wangook sachem received a full debate and hearing. Seguin defended himself by claiming that he had acted against the English only after they had wronged him. He professed to have sold land to the original settlers in 1635 on the understanding that he and his tribesmen might remain in the area and receive protection from the English against the Pequots, for the Wangooks, like the other river tribes, had long resented the harsh hegemony of the Pequots. Unfortunately for Seguin, however, the settlers at Wethersfield either did not understand the terms of the purchase or chose to ignore them. When Seguin set up a wigwam at Wethersfield early in okay, all right, now we're rolling. Okay. Well, none of that human suffering on the part of the two captives and the surviving families. Could such a violent crime be justified by the earlier and relatively milder English wrong? Uncertain themselves, the leaders of the River Colony wrote to Massachusetts for advice. Whatever one may think of Puritan intolerance in matters of religious dissent, there is good reason to applaud the Bay Colony's restrained approach to this problem. Governor Winthrop called in, quote, such magistrates and elders as could meet on the sudden, and presented the question to them. They answered that Seguin, having been the recipient of the first wrong, had been justified in retaliating, quote, either by force or fraud. The magnitude of his revenge was irrelevant, they pointed out. And it goes on. Nor had he forfeited that right by not waiting for a peaceful adjustment of his complaint. He had objected to the injury done him, and his pleas had been ignored. Seguin had observed his side of the covenant. The Wethersfield English had violated theirs and must accept the ensuing horrors. This opinion of the Bay Colony spokesman did not bind Connecticut, but at a meeting of the General Court on April 5, 1638, the Connecticut magistrates announced themselves in full agreement with their neighbor's advice. After a thorough hearing of the evidence, the court decreed that while each party had inflicted injuries on the other, quote, yet because the first breach was on the English part, all former wrongs whatsoever are remitted on both sides, and Seguin is again received in amity to the said English. Well, kind of interesting, kind of at odds with anything I'd ever read before. So, as I say, history is often more interesting than the cardboard cutouts that we often get in the popular culture. Okay, we're going to stop there. I'm going to go get a quick snack. Say hello to the family who just came back from IHOP. And then when I get back, I'll take your questions, and we'll have till 7:45. And we won't have, well, in fact, let's take a five-minute break because of the time thing. Let's do just a five-minute break, and then we'll come back and do the questions, and we'll hold over any remaining questions for next time or discussion board or whatever, okay? All right, so we'll take that quick break. And because we're taking a break of only 5 minutes, I'm not going to fish through for, no, yes, I will. I'll give you a song to listen to during the five-minute break. Okay, back at 8:25 Eastern, and I'll find you a nice song to keep you company. Let's see, what would be a nice song to keep you company? Goodness gracious, what can I do here? Well, let's do some 80s. All right, I'll do a little 80s for you. Okay. This is coming off YouTube, so the sound quality is not perfect, I realize. I haven't got iTunes on this new computer. Okay. We'll see you in a few minutes. I'll just get off the question tape so I'm ready to start. Okay. I was a minute late because I forgot there's one more parent I had to call about my we're having a very belated party for one of our kids, because when it was time for their party, it was a huge snowstorm and we couldn't do it, and so I had to call a parent and invite them. So okay, all right, let's see. I'm gonna go start going through the questions, and then I'll take any questions in the chat if we have time, and let's just roll here. Okay, I'm gonna start from, because I did answer a couple of the questions early, actually by physically typing my answer in. Okay, so we've got Julia's question. I'm noticing a pattern through the reading of men who fought hard for libertarian victories, Coddington, Williams, eventually turning their coats, so to speak. Can these be clear-cut cases of power corrupts, or is there something more complicated to take into account? We can't really get inside their heads, but in some cases it's not, maybe they never envisioned themselves in the first place as arguing for general religious liberty or general, maybe they were just arguing for particular people or particular types of people having the power to, or, you know, having the right to be free. Like, for example, the New England colonies in general, like people think these people were hypocrites because they claimed the freedom for themselves they wouldn't grant to anybody else, but they didn't. You can call that evil or stupid, but that's not hypocritical. That they never said they were for general freedom for everybody. They just wanted to organize their society the way they wanted to organize it, and they wanted to be free to do that. So I don't know. I mean, short of, you'd have to really just get into the biographies of these people, each one at a time. Okay, let's see. Okay, enter Mike Brewer. Wants to know about timing. Yeah, you can view the lectures whenever you want. The quizzes, just as long as you take them over the weekend, that's fine. I read Lou's question, which is kind of just a couple of observations and insights that I think are probably right. I answered the one about the colonies started by companies. The colonies started by the crown. Oh, and then I noticed that Rothbard says that Thomas Morton died in Maine. Did Maine exist as Maine back then? Maine was part of Massachusetts, and in fact, when it was in the Missouri Compromise of around 1820, when Maine was entered as a counterbalance to admitting Missouri, that's where Maine basically came from. It was just detached from Massachusetts. Is the colony that Roger Williams founded present-day Providence, Rhode Island? Yes. How about Pawtuxet? There is a Pawtucket, but it is just north of Providence. Yeah, well, some of these, I think I Googled Pawtuxet, and there is a Pawtuxet, but it's not a town in and of itself. I couldn't quite understand. This is all kind of inside baseball. I think you have to be from Rhode Island to know this stuff. Okay, now the question about a few books I find indispensable. Let's leave that for the end, because that I need to sit and think about for a minute. And then I think I kind of dealt with my Rothbard differences. Let's see. Okay. Oh, okay. Well, I'm not so much saying that the colonists. Where am I here? Matthew Heflin's question number two. I seem to be promoting the idea that the colonists overwhelmingly favored individual rights, despite Winthrop's coercive theology. Well, what I'm more trying to say is that the is kind of what I said tonight about the Massachusetts body of liberties. Isn't so much that they believed in libertarian rights the way we believe in them, but just simply that they wanted some kind of written document they could appeal to that would spell everything out. And it was Winthrop who, for theological reasons, didn't want to do that. And so that was the source of the differences. It wasn't that we had libertarian people and a non-libertarian Winthrop or something to that effect or a mixture of those. It was just a question of how much leeway do we want to give our rulers. Let's see. Yeah, let me go back to the question. Now, because the what books would I recommend question is a little bit off topic, I will answer that question. But let me go back to you guys in the chat room and see if you've got other questions that are related here to the course. Was there any involvement with the okay? Well, the French. Well, the Samuel's question. The French interaction with the Indians is really the most interesting, and there I'm talking primarily about their interaction in Canada, because there the stories there are very interesting. I mean, they tried to establish friendly relations, and to some extent they did, and to some extent they didn't. But there, some of the martyrs who were executed in extremely gruesome ways had really tried genuinely. I mean, the French were really a model. They had tried genuinely to be apostles of mutual understanding, which, I mean, that sounds touchy-feely to us today. But they had tried to understand the native cultures and so on. So, yeah, anything you can read about like Saint Jean Brebeuf or any of these, they're called the North American martyrs. Some of the most interesting stories. Known cases of bribery. I don't know how many. To what degree was the state in each individual life in the colonies then? Well, let's look at that week by week and answer that question. Obviously, we'll see in Pennsylvania it's much less. In Jamestown, it's somewhat less. Because in Jamestown there's a religious establishment, but it's not as overbearing as the New England one. But yeah, let's actually have that in fact I intend to have that as kind of our interpretive framework here as we look at this, is to examine precisely this question. So Floyd, let's just keep an eye on this, because we will talk about economics a bit, and particularly when I have that week called A Tour of the Colonies. That'll give us a chance to do some comparisons. Did John Wesley and the Methodists have any impact here when they came along? Well, the Methodists are more of an 18th century phenomenon, and they did have an impact, but I'm not knowledgeable enough about it. Thomas Hooker write Connecticut's Constitution based on Deuteronomy chapter 1? That's a good question. I don't know. I bet if we Googled it, we could find that out. I actually don't know. Okay. Is there any indication about whether the trading for land that took place was between Puritans and individual Indians, or were the trades struck with a central tribal authority? They were not typically struck with a central tribal authority, although the Indians did have something that was like the equivalent of our eminent domain, you know, whereby the assumption is that in some very abstract sense, the central authority has some kind of inchoate claim to the whole thing, but you can still exercise your rights on it. But that was not a kind of a reflection of the idea of communal ownership. Ownership was people, either individuals owned land, or families owned land, or slightly larger groups owned land, and it just varied from case to case. And so you would interact with those particular people. Could you provide the page number for that quote from Vaughan that I read at the end? Yes. That quote from Vaughan comes from pages 203 to 205 of New England Frontier. Let's see. I don't see other folks' public chat comments. Oh, yeah, somebody's answering that. Okay. Did I cover the business side of why the parents came? Yeah, well, I mean, initially, the people who sent, okay, there are some people who you know, who want to actually physically be part of the company in the sense of they actually want to join the colony and take part in it and actually live over here. And there were other people who thought that maybe this settlement thing, these people could make a go of it and they'll find some marketable crop or whatever. Maybe they'll strike gold. I mean, there was also a thought that precious metals could be found, whatever. But they'll turn around something and I'll just buy shares and make a profit from it. So that was basically the thinking. It was, but for many of the Puritans, those things were combined. And they didn't mind so much that, you know, the colony was prosperous. I mean, not Plymouth, but Massachusetts Bay was fairly prosperous. And they did all right, but it didn't make people super rich. But most of them sort of considered it to have been a success, that they had survived and their numbers had grown and they had established all these churches. And, well, you know, and they were beginning to make inroads with the Indians, and they had peaceful relations with them and commercial relations with them. So it wasn't such a big deal, whereas with Jamestown, there's a much more exclusively financial motivation for the settlement, much, much more so. So there it is kind of much more urgent that the real metric for evaluating the success of the colony is, what did you find there that, you know, in that case it was tobacco. But, you know, what are you going to do that's going to turn a profit in the financial sense? Whereas I think some of the Puritans felt like they had profited in other senses. Okay. Oh, Brian, I actually inadvertently answered your question in the other one. Can Indians belong to the elect? Yes. And in fact, that's a lot of hoops you're expecting them to walk through. You know, like they've got to give testimony of their religious experience with the Holy Spirit. I mean, that's not easy. But yes, absolutely, there were Indians among, they identified Indians among the elect. That they were seeking to do that from the start. Okay, let's see. Yeah, no, I see this. Now I'm saying, you know, Rothbard is saying that all the lands were purchased through tribal authority. I just can't see how that, I mean, because we've got the records of individuals who sold land and then who then show up in a Puritan court. It wasn't always the chief who shows up. It was just some regular guy who shows up. So I don't see that in the reading that I've done. Okay. Oh, sorry. It's this. There. If you find stories about him, and why am I drawing a blank on who some of the other names of the North American martyrs were? But if you just type in North American martyrs, you'd find some very, very interesting stories. Okay, what economic system best describes the Indians when the Pilgrims arrived? Well, I mean, remember, it's an extremely primitive economy to start with. I mean, it is like a hunting and gathering kind of society by and large. I mean, that's another one of the ways in which it's similar to the Stone Age. there is general private property recognized, but there are also taxes too. I mean, the chief, and this part, one of the reasons that the top Indian chieftains were so upset about the praying towns was that they found that it would be impossible. They figured that if some of our people wind up in this town, you know, 15 miles away, totally self-governing town away from everybody, it's going to be much harder to win tribute from them. But everybody is sort of working for himself. It wasn't like they all had to put everything in a central, some kind of central storehouse or something. So, you know, by and large, property was recognized. The persecution of the Quakers. I hold off on the persecution of the Quakers till I do Pennsylvania. Because I give the determination of the Quakers, the fact that they kept going to Massachusetts. They kept going and going and going in spite of, you know, people getting their ears cut off or, you know, the sentence of death being threatened against them. They keep on going and keep on going and keep on going. I do that when I talk about Pennsylvania instead of when I talk about Massachusetts, because I think it gives you an indication of the commitment of the Quakers. And then it becomes easier to understand why they were so uncompromising when it came to political issues, because they were uncompromising on basically everything. So I'm going to talk about them. Yeah, well, and also they felt like the Puritans' attitude to the Quakers basically was, look, we went to all these sacrifices to come over here to have our society, and if you don't like the principles that we're living by, then don't live here. No one's forcing you to live here. You keep coming up and bothering us. Just leave us alone. That was what they felt, and it was disruptive. The Quakers were disrupting Puritan church services. They were walking up and down the church aisles naked during the Puritan church services, and they were lecturing them and yelling at them that their religion was dead and that they needed to get in touch with the inner light that was the center of Quaker theology. Well, that got on the Puritans' nerves. Now, it doesn't mean you should banish them or hurt them, but that was the reason that they did it. Okay. In terms of Rothbard's description of the reason the Mayflower Compact was created, I'm inclined to believe him. And you know what? I've been a U.S. historian for years and years and years, and I had never heard Rothbard's interpretation before. But when I first read Conceived in Liberty, however many years ago it was, I thought, my gosh, this guy brings all these interesting interpretations to something that I thought I was, if not an expert on, then pretty darn knowledgeable. So, I think there's something to it. On the other hand, well, they would have done that anyway, because they did believe in the state as a divine instrument, and they do want to confer legitimacy upon that state, so they would have done it anyway. But I think there is something to the sense of urgency with which they did it. They did it while they were still on the ship. Okay. No, I don't know, Caroline, I don't know. Maybe Rothbard does say it that way, I don't know, but Vaughan and then some of the scholarly literature that I've cited in some of my books sees it very differently. Okay. No, I can't really elaborate on that Plymouth thing. I do know one scholar of Plymouth who argues that the starving time in Plymouth, that story is slightly oversimplified, but I've never seen anything to indicate that it is oversimplified. Let me scroll back up for just a minute. Okay. Were they socialist in sharing the land? Well, I mean, it depends. And first of all, there are a whole bunch of, even though they're all Algonquins one way or another, there are a whole bunch of tribes, and they all have different approaches. But as I say, in particular cases, you had particular forms of ownership, but it was all considered to be private. So it could be a family-owned thing, in which case the fruits would be shared by the family. It could be something other than that, or it could be just an individual. But it was too different. It was too much of a patchwork for us to make generalizations about everybody was sharing the fruits of the land. Not necessarily. Okay, The Black Robe. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed, a good movie. Okay. They probably did use these types of currencies. St. Isaac Jogues, that was the one I was thinking of. Thank you. How could I not? Gosh, my memory the past year or two is just, now I understand why people say, you know, I'm getting old, I can't remember things. I used to think, you lazy bum, think! Okay, let's see. Yeah, all these names, yeah, I should have remembered. Okay. Yeah, that's right, Floy Lilly is here in the room. She's the one who reads, if you're doing the audiobook version. There's an audiobook version of everything I'm assigning to you. And by the way, let me just point out one little source of confusion, because we're going to have to wrap up in a minute. And with regard to the what books have I read that I recommend, or like most important books, ask me that next week, and we'll do that during the chat session. But if you look at the readings that I've assigned for the course, you'll notice that I just want to make sure I get to you the stuff that you absolutely got to read. Okay. All right. Let's see. Yeah, I was just saying that the readings I assigned, they all look like, you know, Conceived in Liberty, Volume 3, over and over and over again. But they're all different. They're all just different parts of Volume 3. And just note that I'm sometimes selectively taking chapters. I had to cut the PDF, split it up, and then merge it back together. Okay. Let me just say, okay, now I know I'm supposed to be off for Kinsella, so I'm going to wrap things up now. Let's see, Patrick. Yeah, David, that's a good question. I don't actually know the answer to that question. I think there are some parallels, but I do think there are genuine cases of real oppression of natives. I mean, like Belgium and the Congo, for example. So it's not always just people you know, exaggerating or whatever. Does everybody feel like this sort of went okay? This is my first time doing this particular course, so you feel like this went okay? And if you want to say no, that's all right. I can take it. Okay, good. Oh, nice. Okay, great. Oh, good. Nice. You guys are great. Okay, I better get out of here before Kinsella tries giving away my books for free. So thank you all, everybody. That was an IP joke. And we'll see you next time. I'm going to click stop, Danny, right? Is that what I want to do? Just want to click stop. It's as simple as that. I'm rusty. Okay, thank you all, everybody. Thanks to Danny for being in here. Thanks to Floyd Lilly being our celebrity guest. And thanks to everybody. Okay, good night, everybody.